thank you so much for being here.
I miss Tom Friedman.
Your wife was, so there's Tom right there, John Doerr, Tom.
Tom, you have a wonderful daughter.
Yeah. And Tom,
my dad used to have an expression. He'd say, you know your success as a father, you look at your kid and you realize they turned out better than you. She's better than your kid. She's better than you. I'm a success as well.
And if Orly's wondering where her knapsack is in my office because they wouldn't let her bring it in because she had juices in it. So, thank you for being here. The vice president, everybody knows much about him, but what you most know about him is he actually cares about every person in America, gets up, has that instinct that every working and middle-class person needs to be part of our prosperity. I've heard him talk about this since 1973 or so when you entered the Senate. And so, once again, let's give him a warm Aspen welcome. If we could, I'd like to start with what the president most recently tasked you to do, which is this moonshot on cancer. It wasn't something you knew a lot about, except for from a deeply personal perspective. Tell me what you've learned, what we're doing, how we're fighting cancer now.
I'd like to ask one question before I begin. Newt, are you going to do it?
Newt, we're
all right, that's okay. That's all I wanted to know. I wanted to get to the important things out of the bat.
And,
I think he needs to help, yes.
The question was, should I?
Should he be vice president? I tell him. Anyway, it's a hell of a job. Get a big pay raise, it's all work. Anyway, I'm sorry. You asked a serious question.
No, actually, right before, because that's not bad. should he, not just Speaker Gingrich, but should somebody be? I mean, is there something you've really shown what you could do as vice president?
I don't know about
tell
that.
Me about that job.
And well,
tell
you
Newt
know,
about the job.
As Newt's buddy sitting to his left, an old friend of mine too, the damn Republican, but I love him.
Ann Korologos, our former chair.
All kidding aside, when I was asked to consider this by then Senator Obama, when he was the presumptive nominee, I actually thought I could help him better by not doing it, by staying in the Senate. And he said he needed an answer right away, and I told him, no, I don't want to be considered. And he said, how much time do you need? So I went home and talked with my family. He asked me to go home and talk. And then Jill was right that I should do it. It's been the most rewarding thing I've done, only for one reason. There is no inherent power in being vice president, none, zero. It totally, completely, thoroughly depends on your relationship with the president of the United States, whomever that vice president is. And the great benefit for me is that in the 13 debates we had seeking the nomination, he and I are the only two that never disagreed in principle on any specific, on any issue, tactic we disagreed. He's been an absolute man of his word. He asked what I wanted, if there was any one request to do it. I said, I just want to be the last guy in the room. I mean, not figuratively, literally, the last person in the room. He's president. He makes the decision. But after all the years I spent in the Senate, I wanted an opportunity to try to affect the outcome of some of these vital decisions. And he's been absolutely, thoroughly consistent. And the interesting part is, he said it a different way, as only the president could say. He said, to my surprise, we became great friends. I said, but he has become a very close personal friend. And what's made it all work is our families are close. My number three granddaughter and his number two daughter, each other's best friend. They vacation together. They're in the same school together. The same teams together. Jill and Michelle are good friends. So it's worked out really well because he's been inclusive. But there's no, and the other thing I've found, and I think Newt would agree with this because he's studied it, the job of president is so complicated these days that there's no one woman or one man that can do it without being willing to trust someone else to give them major responsibility. And so, therefore, you have to have a genuine relationship. You have to be on the same page. And so when we did the Recovery Act, which I know a lot of folks didn't like, I think was a great success, the president just said, do it. I never once checked with him. I never went back. He gave me control over the cabinet. The same with other things we've done. So it's not because anything special about me. It's just the job is so big. And it's gotten so broad, and the world has changed so drastically, you really need someone who is value-added. So I wasn't kidding. Newt and I disagree, but he's one of the brightest guys I know. He knows the government, he knows the issues, and I would feel better, even though we disagree philosophically. Now, I'm not being facetious. I'd feel better knowing that there was somebody there with the depth and gravitas on the issues. That Newt possesses. There are others who possess it as well. So that's a long way of saying that the relationship, the personal relationship, really, really, really matters. Trust matters. And what I've been able to do because of his trust, when I've traveled 1,200,000 miles around the world, Tom and I have talked about this, when I show up with another head of state and I say something, they know I speak for the president. No one wonders. No one wonders up. Some of my colleagues in the Senate wonders if I say something in the House or Senate. And it's not because of me. It's because he said, I have this relationship with Biden. Biden speaks for me. And if you do it well, and I hope I've done it somewhat well, it can be a very value added for the president.
Right. Well.
I never looked for this job, though.
I know. But
we never ran for vice president.
We will know in 2 weeks whether your endorsement today of Newt Gingrich as vice president will help his chances his chances to be the vice presidential running mate.
I want to make it clear. I want to make it clear. Donald, I am not endorsing.
Okay.
I'm not. I'm just saying he's bright as hell. I disagree with him, though.
Let's go back, if we can, to the moonshot. Explain what the moonshot is.
Well, look, the moonshot, you know, one of the things that I sometimes almost regret we called it the moonshot because, Kennedy and Nixon talked about a moonshot and people expect that there's some kind of epiphany that's going to occur and there's going to be a breakthrough on all cancers. We're going to cure cancer. That was never what this was about. The way this came about is I said when I announced I wasn't running, and Newt, I found out you want to be popular, announced you're not running for president. If I'd known this, I would have announced every day I'm not running. But I said, and it was more wistful, Walter, than anything else, I said in the Rose Garden, but I would have liked to have been the president who presided over a fundamental change in cancer. And the reason I say that is we've reached an inflection point, and some of the real experts that are in this audience know it. We've reached an inflection point that didn't exist during Nixon's time. For the first time, I learned when our son, Jill and I, when our son was going through what he went through, that up to 5 years ago, immunology was like it was out in the wilderness. No one paid any attention. There was very little collaboration and cooperation between virologists and immunologists and genomic science. I mean, there was none of that. There was no collaboration. But now there is. It's only just beginning. It's beginning. There's a lot more to do, but. The difference between when Nixon announced it now, we've mapped the human genome. We're in a position where immunology is making significant strides. We have cooperation with all. We have everyone from mechanical engineers to biochemists that are engaged in the enterprise. And it's, for example, when Nixon announced it, we had no idea there were 200 different cancers.
This Nixon announced a war on cancer.
I'm sorry, I beg your pardon. I beg your pardon. So what we've decided, the president and I, he decided was that I believe we could make 5 years of progress what otherwise would take 10 years. Even if we didn't have another single major breakthrough, if we take all the information we have available so now, better organize it, correlate it, share it, change the way the federal government operates, its various agencies, the way everyone from the FDA to the NIH, the way the drug companies move, the way in which we do dual trials, the way we share information. For example, now we can do, I know you know this because you've written about it, we can do a million billion calculations per second. And so the ability to find patterns of why cancers form, why a cancer cell develops, how it metastasizes, give me an example. There was a study done, I think it was with 1,400 women on Medicare on ovarian cancer. And they used one therapy on all of them. Only a handful benefited from the therapy. And they're trying to figure out why that was the case. But because there were only 1,400, they went back and they aggregated all the health records, the backgrounds of these women, what they were, what other medicines they were taking, what their lifestyles were, et cetera. And to oversimplify it, what they found out was those women who were taking a statin while they were taking this anti-ovarian cancer drug, they did the best. They did the best. Now imagine with our ability to sequence the cancer genome. Imagine if we're able to aggregate the biopsies that have been done on cancer. Imagine if we can aggregate the lifestyles, the treatment process, et cetera, all in one place. We had 2 million, 5 million, 10 million folks in that one spot. The ability of these supercomputers to go in and find patterns, to find out what it is in terms of everything from lifestyle to what other drugs you're taking, to find answers as to why so many people, all of you know somebody who has suffered from cancer. All of you know somebody, and maybe some of you, who are dealing with fighting cancer. And you know people with the same exact diagnosis taking the same drug, two different outcomes. Imagine if we were willing to share this data. Imagine what we could do. And so there's a lot of breakthroughs that are possible, but we have to change sort of the culture a little
bit. Let me push on that a bit, because for that to work, you have to be able to be counted into a big database. HIPAA makes it very hard to share electronic medical records. It's difficult for me even to get my electronic medical records, you know, from Washington out here. Why haven't we been able to break the back, as Eric Lander said earlier this week, as Sylvia Burwell said earlier this week, break the back on big data and getting our data in if we want it?
Come hell or high water, I'm going to break the back.
Yes.
No, not a joke. Because
no, I mean, it's important.
Because what's happening here is, look, I'll try to be delicate.
Don't.
The culture of medical research does not rest on sharing data and information, number one. And it's not, by the way, they're all good guys and good women. It's just the way in which it's developed over the last 100 years, number one. Number two, you have, when I keynoted the Davos this year I was asked, though, before I would do that, would I have a round table on cancer? And I had two Nobel laureates at that round table. I had a number of folks of heads of major hospitals. And they started talking to me about how there's Orion, there is CancerLink, there are a number of these new organizational structures where you have philanthropy and major hospitals that have major hospitals. And what they're doing is they're correlating data, all the data they have, in one place. And so I asked them all to come visit me, and I won't mention them all, but five, where close to $1 billion are being spent to aggregate this data. And I said, tell me what you're doing. And I sat in the ceremonial office of the Eisenhower building at that big conference table. And they all told me what they're doing. And I said, well, it sounds like you're all doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not being facetious. And they all kind of put their heads down. And I said, wouldn't we go make a hell of a lot more progress if it was all open data, if you shared it all? And the answer was, yeah. And after we broke up, and two of the heads of these major outfits came up to me and said, keep the pressure on. I can't do this myself. I mean, I'm not able to, you know. So there is a growing recognition on the part of the major, I've visited now 10 or 11 of the major cancer centers in America, in the world, but they're in America. I have spent a better part of a day at each one of them. I have I've spoken to over 9,000 cancer researchers. These two large organizations represent them. I've privately met with over 280 of the leading virologists, oncologists, immunologists in the world. They all privately say basically the same thing. They say that we're not sharing data well enough, and if we did, we could exponentially increase the potential to find answers to a whole range of questions relating to cancer therapies. Number two, they say that it is very difficult to be able to do dual trials with different medicines. You represent one drug company, I represent another. A bright young researcher says, I think the combination of those two could really have a potential impact, and it does. They say that they're not enough. There's no way, if any of you have gone through it, where if you want to find out whether you can get in a cancer trial, there's no place you can go to find out every cancer trial that's going on in the United States. Hell, I can get on. You can get on, you know, Uber can tell you exactly where everybody is, how to, you know, I mean.
Well, let's pick that one. How do we get more people access to information about getting into cancer trials?
Well, here's what we're doing. We are changing. We're going to have at NIH, we're having a new website. I knew you'd ask me that, so I can't remember what the hell the name of the website is. But
Greg, what's the website?
But we'll, as I say, get it to you. But there's going to be a new website where we are going to aggregate every single solitary trial that takes place in the United States of America. Because here's what happens. If you don't live near a major cancer center, you don't live near MD Anderson, or you don't live near the Hutch, I can name them all, and you're an oncologist in a rural area in the Midwest or anywhere in the country, you have a patient you diagnosed with a particular cancer, and you want to get them in a trial, you have no idea how the hell to get them associated with or tied up with or connected with that trial. So there's going to be one place, we're in the process of putting this site together now, and that NIH is, where you can click on and you can find out what every trial for every type of cancer that's being conducted. It's also a helpful thing for the pharmaceutical companies. They have trouble finding people to be in their trials. And the perception is that people don't want to give their information. Well, they're much more ready and willing to give their information, and it can be done, and your privacy protected very easily. But up to now, there's been no willingness to decide there's going to be one site, one place.
And in return, should the pharmaceutical companies try to keep a lid on these $100,000 a year drugs?
Well, that's not necessarily related, but yes, they should try to keep a lid. But here's, look, in fairness to the companies, they drill a lot of dry holes. They spend a lot of money doing a lot of tests that cost tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. They get no return on their investment. But there's some place between the sweet spot between a legitimate return on your investment and holding hostage people who need the drug to live but can't possibly afford the drug. For example, there is one particular drug that's been very, very helpful. I don't want to pick on a particular company. One particular drug has been very helpful for a lymphoma cancer, a particular one. When the drug came out 15 years ago, and it's pretty miraculous impact it has for this particular cancer, it was $26,000 a year. Now, if I'm not mistaken, I don't know where Greg Simon is, but I think it's $149,000 a year. Let me ask you a rhetorical question. Imagine if Jonas Salk decided that he was going to patent, like drug companies do, essentially get a patent for his vaccine for polio. And he said, okay, I'm going to charge $1,000 a shot. What the hell would have happened? What would happen? There's some place between a rational return on an investment and profit, particularly since an awful lot of what drug companies are able to accomplish are a consequence of taxpayer investment in research and development. There's about somewhere between $80 and $100 billion a year in research done by a myriad of outfits out there to try to find cures or drugs that will increase the lifespan. About $30 billion of that's federal money. And so there is some correlation here between their progress, their success, and their societal obligation. And I think this can be done. Excuse my back to people over here. I apologize. And my Secret Service agent is 8 feet tall, so I can't see you here. By the way, he's a great guy. I'm embarrassing the hell out of him right now. But he was a hell of a basketball player. That's another question. Anyway. I don't get a chance to embarrass them very often. Yeah. But to make a long story not quite so long, there has to be. I met with industry a roundtable at the Cancer Moonshot Summit we had, and a number of industry personnel. We had a roundtable, was off the record, with about 20 people, and I said, look, we have to have an adult conversation about this. There's got to be a way. We've got to find a way through here. You know, as Lasker said, if you think drugs are expensive, try disease. I'm paraphrasing. And so there is a correlation between the communal obligation, the public obligation to underwrite the cost of some of these drugs that exceed the cost that is imposed, that is incurred by drug companies in producing these drugs. But it's a debate that has to take place because you're going to see in the next 6 months to the next 5 years, you're going to see some significant drug applications that can extend and save lives that the price tag on them is absolutely prohibitive, including copays. Last point, and this is not a political point, it's a practical point. Without the Affordable Care Act or something replacing it, you would have tens of millions of people who could not even remotely afford some of the expensive but much less expensive drug requirements that cost $10,000, $20,000, and $30,000 a year. So if you're a family of four making less than $60,000, you still have great trouble, but you don't ever have to pay more than $12,000. That's a gigantic chunk of your income. But still, it's within the reach of some people to be able to do. But without that, I mean, we're going to find you have a revolution on our hands, figuratively speaking.
Mm-hmm. What about if you have your? Yeah, you can keep that. I think mine's working. You know, trust me. What if you had your gene sequence? You're on one of these drug trials. How do we make it easier to say, count me in? Put all of my data out there in the public realm for people to use.
Well, there's two things. One, you got to make clear to people they own their data.
Yeah.
And right now, it's not so clear they do. Right now, there is, I remember, Jill won't like me mention this because it's, I remember with Bo, my son, the Attorney General, I assumed that the sequence of his human genome, he owned, that he could do whatever he wanted with it. Not accurate. I assumed that all the records that they had of his battle for over 2 years
with glioblastoma, that they could be made available. Not so clear. The cost of getting those records was, and by the way, he was at a great, wonderful hospital with incredible doctors. I don't want to turn this into a screed about, but just practical things that are really, really difficult to work your way through. For example, we all heard, and Democrats and Republicans have talked about how much money we could save in the healthcare system, and how much we could increase the efficacy of certain medicines, as well as recommendations by docs as how to treat all kinds of diseases, if we had electronic record keeping.
Right.
Well, you know, I know a lot of folks don't like the fact that the Recovery Act was over $800 billion, but to be blunt with it, the president and I sat down and said, while we're doing this, we might as well try to make government function better. And so we did things that bothered people that Amy loved and others didn't, like, focus $100 billion in education, $48 billion on a high, infrastructure, more than the interstate highway system, et cetera. One of the things we did, we put in $35 billion for electronic record keeping. Well, what happened is five great outfits came along and they all bid for it. They all got a piece of it and they all made sure they couldn't talk to each other.
It's amazing.
So
incompatible.
I'll give you a practical example. A lot of you know this. You know, there's a great advantage to all of you in this room. We probably have greater access to the best people than other people may have. As Vice President of the United States, my son was a decorated war veteran. He was, we got him to MD, anybody could get to, but we got him to MD Anderson, and toward the end, he turned out to be part of a trial of one with two experimental programs that were last ditch. They were immunotherapies designed to get the T cells to focus on the cancer, break the blood-brain barrier, get to the cancer, and essentially eat up the cancer, in layman's terms. But it required him to have MRIs regularly, meaning a couple times a day, to see what was happening, how it was going. And what we found out was when he was at, because he had been up here, he was at Walter Reed in Bethesda, and they were very good. They had a great team as to following what MD Anderson wanted him doing in terms of the particular MRIs and the focus, et cetera. And we found out there's no way to get the information.
Astonishing.
Down. So the medical doc assigned to me, a really great diagnostician, a good guy, Doc O'Connor, former Delta, he was going in, and my son-in-law, who's sounds self, but he's a leading surgeon in the Delaware Valley, does at Jefferson Hospital, does cancer flaps, reconstructs people's bodies and faces with cancer. And because they both knew their way around, what they do, they go in and take a picture of the MRI on a cell phone. And or getting on a plane and flying down. Now, that is bizarre. I mean, it really is bizarre. And there's no incentive for any one of these five outfits to say, hey, look, let's all get together. And so one of the things I'm finding is I've gone
around
the...
Can you push that?
Yes,
can you
we
make
can.
That happen?
Here's what I think we can do. There is a growing consensus among the best people in the country across the board in all of the disciplines that relate to the fight against cancer that we should have a common language. Like, for example, when the human genome was sequenced, we found out that, you're talking about a couple billion pieces of information and thousands of genes, and it was so big that we concluded no one outfit could do it. So what we did is we went around the world, literally, and we handed out, we said, okay, you take, I'm being figurative, yeah. you take A to C, and you take C to P, and we broke it up. But the condition was that each of these organizations, and some were in other countries, had to immediately share all of the data that they got with one another. It was insisted by the NIH that it had to be done that way. So we cracked the human genome. We actually were able to do that in sharing that information instantaneously. And now in the human genome, there is a common language. You must use the precise language that is needed, the precise terminology, in order to do anything in terms of dealing with the genome. There is no such precise language as it relates to medical records. So one, to oversimplify it, one doc will write down, a broken leg. Other guy will write down a broken femur. Another guy will write down a fractured tip. And there's no way the computer can go out and aggregate all that data. So one of the things I proposed when I started this 5 months ago is, why don't we insist on a common language and electronic record keeping? Well, that made a lot of people very angry. But at the last moonshot, where we had over 9,000 people participating, you had leading members of the industry and medicine saying, we need a common language. And that's one of the things I talked to one of the brightest guys I've ever met, is Lander.
Eric Lander, at MIT.
You know, so we're talking about how we can get a consensus among these various large entities that we have a common language in electronic record keeping.
You mentioned a couple of times what you learned from your son, Beau's treatment. What about emotionally? Walk us through that.
I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I'll bet 20% of you have had someone close to you die or go through a pretty damn tough period of time. And one of the things that we all have in common in this tent is that when someone you love, when someone you adore, when someone's your soul, and they have a problem, particularly if they're your child or your spouse, or just any, but particularly if you're your child, what you try to do is you try to learn as much as you possibly can about whatever that crisis is facing that child at that moment. And so that's what Jill and I did. And and one of the things for us, at least, and for my Ashley, my daughter sitting here, who is the love of his life, was that we knew the August before at Anderson that he received a death sentence. Stage 4 glioblastoma, the brain. Virtually no one makes it. But like all of you, you've been through this, hope matters. My mother used to say, as long as you're alive, you have an obligation to strive, and you're not dead till you've seen the face of God. And you have to have hope. And for Jill and me and my whole family, Bo made it I don't know how to say it easier. Bo made it possible for us to get up every morning and put one foot in front of the other. Like when Bo, 6 months before he left, he sat me down. Jill and I were having dinner at his home, and on a Friday, we come home every weekend, and he asked his wife, Hallie, a wonderful woman, if she could put the kids upstairs and come back down, and he sat down with me, and he said, Dad, I know no one loves me more than you do, but Dad, look at me. Look at me. I said, honey, I'm looking at you. And he said, Dad, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be okay no matter what happens. But you got to promise me, Dad. Promise me. Promise me you're going to be okay. You've got to be okay, Dad. Look at me, Dad. You've got to be okay. And so Bo, for us, was, you know, he every time we'd get sort of down, it was the kid who was, he just gathered the family up and he'd say, now, come on, damn it, come on. And so it was maybe a different experience than some people have. But as my son Hunter said, he said, Dad, I don't know whether to thank you or hate you for teaching us how to love each other so much. Because, you know, well, you all know, you know. I'm not. But the one thing Bo did was, you know, I know since I'm not running, you know what I mean, intention of running, I can say it now. Bo made us all promise, not a joke, promise that we'd stay engaged, man, that we'd push this. You know, my dad used to have an expression, he'd say, Joey, never complain and never explain. Not one time from the moment he was born, you can and will not find a living person will tell you Bo Biden ever, 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 ever once complained about a thing. And so he looked at us and was like, you know, you got to stay in the game. You got to get up. As he'd say, you got to put one foot in front of the other. Just move, move. So we've decided to, I'll conclude with this. We decided to look at what happened to our beau and focus on what he'd want us to be doing, what he'd want us to be working on, what he'd what would make him proud of us, of the things that he cared so deeply about. And I hope I'm saying it the right way, babe.